The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Tell them Fred sent you. Thank them very much for sponsoring Our State for all those years. And now it's time for us to return to the March 2019 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We're reading the series Marvelous Modernist Homes, and we are moving on now to a section called The Visionary, Blueprint for a Movement. A tenacious architect with a lofty goal turned North Carolina State University into a powerhouse of modernist design. Henry Camp Hufner has been called a rock star, a cast iron SOB, an incredible visionary, and an arrogant curmudgeon. He was a man with a hard and hardened persona, one of the most enlightened design educators of his time, and someone who changed the architectural landscape of North Carolina. It's been 47 years since the founding dean of North Carolina State University's legendary School of Design stepped down, but his legacy is still felt statewide. In the Triangle area alone, there are some 800 modernist homes, as architects continue to practice the modernist architectural orthodoxy Camp Hufner preached. His tenure at State from 1948 to 1972 was a jolt to the complacency of traditional design philosophy there, and it wasn't without controversy. Even today, there's no shortage of opinions, both positive and negative, about the man who boldly altered the trajectory of modern architecture. He was a combination of Frank Lloyd Wright and the Bauhaus, and that was indicative of the faculty he brought to the school, says Durham architect Tehran Duda, a 1976 graduate of the School of Design. They were educators first, but also artists, sculptors, industrial designers, architects, and landscape architects, Duda says. He wanted to expand the idea of what design is and what it should be. A rigid modernist and professor of architecture at the University of Oklahoma, Camp Hufner was recruited by North Carolina State in 1947. He was no pushover. Retired North Carolina State professor Roger Clark wrote in a 2000 book on him that Camp Hufner insisted on four discussions before he'd even consider the position of dean. He wanted the head of architecture replaced with a man of national reputation. He wanted one particular tenured professor's resignation, and he wanted five other non-tenured professors fired or replaced and replaced by six others with a 60% salary increase. And he wanted space specifically for the new school. He got it all. By the fall of 1948, classes at the new School of Design had commenced. Camp Hufner modeled his new program after Harvard's Graduate School of Design, and with a good dose of interdisciplinary spirit prevalent at Black Mountain College near Asheville. Students were required to take a course in fine arts, either painting or sculpture, and to learn to plaster and lay brick. The faculty that Camp Hufner recruited was legendary. George Matsumoto, James Fitzgibbon, Duncan Smart, and Edward Wow. He appointed Matthew Nowicki head of the architecture department. When Nowicki died in a plane crash, Camp Hufner replaced him with exiled Argentine genius Eduardo Catalano. One coup was hiring modernist master Harwell Hamilton Harris, who'd trained with Rudolf Schindler in California. Camp Hufner insisted that they all practice and teach. As a result, North Carolina boasts buildings that are standard bearers of the modernist movement. There's the Fathom House, designed in 1949 by Fitzgibbon, with multiple buildings by Milton Small, who studied with architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. Matsumoto's exquisite Japanese-influenced homes are, quote, as radically modern today as they were in 1955, Duda says. And, of course, there's J.S. Dorton Arena on the State Fairgrounds, with its saddle-shaped roof supported by torqued steel cables. Designed by Nowicki, the structure is a direct result of the theories and practices that were being investigated at the school. When Dorton opened to the public in 1952, it was called the greatest building of its time. One of Camp Hefner's strokes of genius was to leave a single teaching position vacant and use its salary to fund visiting professionals who came to the school not just to lecture, but also to teach and socialize with students. Frank Lloyd Wright's lecture in Raleigh commanded an audience of more than 5,000 people, a stunning turnout for a city of only 95,000 at the time. Buckminster Fuller, creator of the geodesic dome, and modernist Richard Neutra and Marcel Breuer visited too. Mies van der Rohe came from Chicago to see the construction of Dorton Arena and to speak with students. According to legend, he downed martinis and smoked cigars with them in a walk-up apartment on Hillsborough Street. At the end of the night, he took a tumble down the stairs and managed to keep walking, impressing the students all the more. But Camp Hefner wasn't welcoming all talent. Raleigh was still a segregated city in the 1960s, and the School of Design under Camp Hefner was no different. There were no African-American instructors, and the first black student did not arrive until 1966, when Arthur Clement was admitted. Burning the midnight oil, while others around him dropped out, Clement got through his 5 years, bringing J. Max Bond Jr., the preeminent African-American architect, to visit the campus, and graduated in 1971. Still, he had to endure Camp Hefner's lukewarm at best reaction to his presence whenever they met. "You're still here," he'd say to me every year, Clement recalls. Camp Hefner held negative attitudes toward women in architecture, too. After Raleigh architect and attorney Teresa Rosenberg interviewed with the dean in 1961, her father asked her, "Why would you ever want to be somewhere where you know you're not wanted?" But she knew what she wanted and went on to graduate in 1971. "It never occurred to me that Camp Hefner was doing anything but his shtick," she says. Durham architect Phil Zostak, the architect for the Durham Performing Arts Center and Adelhoff Hotels, recalls talking to Camp Hefner as a junior in high school. He said there could be no girlfriends and no sports once you were here. He was asking for a full commitment, Zostak says. More shtick? Perhaps. But anyone determined to sprinkle modern architects from Boone to Wilmington, and in just two generations, no less, couldn't possibly abide flirting from his students, or even himself. That was written by J. Michael Welton, who is the architect critic for the News and Observer. Next in the Modern North Carolina series, we have The Haven, the Warmth of Glass and Stone. Growing up in a modernist masterpiece taught Sue Sisters that a house is far more than a home, it's a feeling. Written by Robin Eugene Smith. Whenever architect F. Carter Williams sat down with a new client to design a home, he'd ask a seemingly simple question. How do you want this space to feel? But the only time he knew for certain that he'd gotten it right was when he built Blue Haven in 1959, the mid-century modernist gem he designed for his family. That spring, soon after Masons placed the final Carolina blue fieldstone, Carter, his wife, A.V., short for Alice Virginia, and their teenage daughters, Carol and June, began to fill up the closets in the airy, sunlit, dappling rooms. The smell of new carpet soon gave way to aromas of supper simmering on the stove. In the living room, the heart of the house, A.V. tinkered with new songs on the grand piano, while behind her, massive windows welcomed the trees inside. This was the haven that Carter had envisioned. The noted professor of architecture at North Carolina State University had no interest in ever selling Blue Haven, but he was a practical man, and at 87 years old, he realized that it was time to say goodbye. For 41 summers, he'd listened to rain drip off the eaves outside the great windows. He'd welcomed guests for birthdays and bridge clubs and celebrated 40 Christmases by singing holiday songs around the piano with the girls and later their husbands, then the grandchildren. Blue Haven's bedroom wing once suffered the wrath of a tornado that toppled pines onto the roof. But Carter took the repairs in stride. The structure was strong, sure, and timeless, and he was certain that it would endure. And so, on Easter Sunday of 2000, Carter and Avey gathered their family in the empty living room, their boxes and belongings having been moved to their new apartment in Cary. Carter expressed his gratitude to the wood, glass, and stone that held irreplaceable memories. His older daughter, Carol, snapped a final photo of him, looking out the living room windows. Before he and A.V. walked out the front door for the final time, Carter placed on the mantel a framed photo that he'd taken of the house's new owners, the Harris family, who would close on the property the following day. "I hope they'll love this house as much as we have," Carol recalls him saying. That photo was the only thing he left behind. Fred Carter Williams taught architectural design at West Point in North Carolina State, where his papers are now archived, and designed more than 600 projects, including buildings on campuses at Duke, North Carolina State, and ECU. The North Carolina Archives Library, the 1975 renovation of the Governor's Mansion, and Pullen Memorial Baptist Church, where A.V. played the organ for many years. The esteemed architects and engineers who taught at State or visited the campus often stopped by Blue Haven to pay Carter a visit. Carol once served punch to the modernist visionary Buckminster Fuller. Still, luminaries didn't matter much to teenagers Carol and June, who were more concerned with what the house's location, 8 miles from their old home in Raleigh, would mean for their social lives. For June, a ninth grader at Daniels Junior High School, the thrill of having her own room and 40 acres of woods to roam was quickly dampened by a realization. "Nobody's going to come out here," she remembers thinking, wondering if she'd ever have a date. "Nobody's going to drive their car up this bumpy dirt road." The situation felt a bit more dire for Carol, a senior at Broughton High School, which is why their mother's first official party at Blue Haven was an afternoon tea. "We literally invited all the mums and their daughters," Carol says, remembering the hundreds of handwritten invitations. The silver punch bowl, her father directing cars out front. The ladies marveled at the stone foundation in the, or rather fountain, in the entryway. The sleek, modern kitchen. The dumbwaiter. "I remember feeling a little bit embarrassed," Carol says shyly. "I felt so blessed to have such a beautiful home." The highlight of any visit to Blue Haven, at least for teenage girls, was the bathtub. Carter had allowed each daughter to pick one design feature for the new house. For June, small sinks in both the girls' rooms, bedrooms. Carol requested a sunken bathtub, pink tile, three steps down. Outrageous, yet functional and festive. Carter liked it so much that he installed one in the master bathroom as well. It's not pink. After June got to Broughton, Blue Haven became a gathering place where she and her friends would practice cheers in the basement and primp for high school dances. "My dates had to leave 30 minutes early in order to get me home by 11 p.m., she says with a laugh. Boys were allowed to linger before heading back to town, but whispered conversations in deck chairs under the stars could only last so long. Carter had installed state-of-the-art intercoms and a sophisticated lighting system in the house, all of which could be controlled from the master bedroom. When it was time for a young man to leave, June chuckles, mother and dad would just start flashing lights all over, which meant it was time to go. The house had this way of making you feel warm and embraced by the wood and glass and stone, Carol says. It was really a haven, a safe place for all of them. After Carol started her own family, her husband, Bob Bilbro, was sent to Korea, and she accepted her parents' invitation to move back home, arriving on Blue Haven's doorstep with an energetic toddler and a baby. "Haven was an important word to my father," Harold says. "Indeed, the house is on a street that Carter named, Rest Haven. He wanted the house to have that feeling. Carter was at peace when he left Blue Haven for the last time, that Sunday, Easter Sunday in 2000. He told the new family he would explain all of the special features of the house as they settled in. When he and A.V. returned to their new apartment, he retired to the study after dinner to fill out change of address cards. That evening, he passed away with the pen still in his hand. The next day, the sale went through. Blue Haven got a new family. Since then, the house has changed hands only one other time, when Jill Maurer, the current owner, bought it. "I didn't really know mid-century modern at the time," says Jill, who felt a connection to the house because she and a realtor even got out of the before she and a realtor even got out of the car. "I never had a feeling like that about a house. Never thought I would. But I've seen other people experience it when they walk in." Jill dedicated herself to learning everything she could about Blue Haven. First, she reached out to the previous owners. Later, she even contacted the original landscape architect, Dick Bell, well-known in modernist design circles, and a dear friend of Carter's. He offered to make updates free of charge in exchange for martinis. Like Carol and June, Jill feels protective of the place, its history, and all the memories contained within its walls. "You feel a sort of an oath to the house," she says. But now her sons are grown, and it's time for her to move on as well. The 60-year-old house is once again in search of a new owner, which, even after all these years, is emotional for Carol and June, who watch from their own homes in Raleigh. "It's been comforting to me to reminisce about the power of place and the power of design in my father's life," Carol says. "Dad understood how creating a design for a space could reflect a person's attitude toward life and leave a legacy to be explored and loved by those who follow." And next we have Modern Living Charlotte, the Ranch Revival. In Charlotte, a broker and an architect have come up with a new twist on a classic design. It doesn't fit in with today's trends, and that's the point. Written by Jen Tota McGivney. Nostalgia led Scott Tony to buy this house, even before its construction was complete. It's a mid-century style ranch in a mid-century neighborhood, even though it was built in 2017. "The house where I grew up and all the houses in my neighborhood when I was a kid were mid-century ranches," Tony says. "They had weird little features. Man, I miss those houses." He downsized from a large English country-style home in Plaza Midwood to this stylish 1,563-square-foot ranch just a few blocks east in Country Club Heights. Surrounding the house are three other new ranches, and surrounding those is a neighborhood full of 1950s and 1960s originals. We can pause here to allow the obvious joke that the closest Charlotte gets to respecting history is building new things that look like old things. But the joke's not quite right this time. This is about a broker and an architect building a love letter to the mid-century ranch and, as they did, restoring a corner of a neighborhood to the way it was meant to be all along. That broker's name is Charlie Miller. And if he had put his plan to a committee, it would have been vetoed. His idea? To build four unique mid-century style ranches on Palm Ave in Country Club Heights. Their size would be a fit for the neighborhood, but their bold styles would make a statement. Miller called his vision the Atomic Palm Project. Country Club Heights spent decades as a sleepy suburb of modernist homes and tall trees, but recently it has become a hip neighborhood. As real estate prices soar, the closer you get to the center of the city, this spot, just around the corner from Plaza Midwood, and a short drive to uptown, has become hot with buyers. Ranches are a bad idea for cities, usually. The economics of urban development typically call for homes with as much square footage and as small a footprint as possible. If you're going to build a foundation and a roof, you want to maximize the money-making stuff in between. The narrow two-story craftsman-style homes popping up around this neighborhood illustrate that. But Miller has a vision for ranches, single-story, big footprint ranches, and he needed a partner. He reached out to architect Rachel Taylor of THR Design Build. Charlie came to me and said, "I've got this cool idea," Taylor says. After he told me, I thought, ranches. I get to design ranches. I never get to design ranches. This is awesome. Mid-century style ranches may have economic drawbacks, but they're fun to design. Every ceiling can be vaulted. Transom windows suffuse light into the rooms. And don't get Miller and Taylor started on angled roof lines. They swoon over a butterfly roof. They'd make more money with two-story houses, sure, but would they have this much fun? Miller found a one-acre lot, actually six lots, that had long ago been combined by a single buyer with one house in the middle. The original home was in beautiful shape, and Miller wouldn't raise it. He hired home movers to relocate it 150 yards to make room for the Atomic Palm Project. It took 10 days for them to separate the brick from the foundation and 10 minutes for them to move it. Miller says it was too nice to tear down. Miller subdivided the land into five lots. The new homes he built on them are full of big windows, overhangs, and interesting roof lines. One house has one of the few butterfly roofs on a single-family home in Charlotte. And unlike many of the new homes here, these stand apart without towering over the rest. There are a lot of developers who come in from somewhere else and look to make a quick buck. They'll stick whatever house plan fits on a plot of land and sell it. That's kind of a bummer, Taylor says. We live here. We try to be as respectful as possible and be kind to the neighbors. The success and fun of the Atomic Palm Project encouraged Miller and Taylor to partner on two new mid-century-style ranch projects, and they've got an eye out for opportunities for more. Making new houses like these is filling a need, says Tony, a real estate agent. When really nice mid-centuries hit the market, the old original ones, they get snatched up quickly, and invariably the buyers are the ones with a bit of vision and a sense of fun in what they want with a house. Tony's home is stunning. The angled ceiling in the living room peaks at 18 feet, with front windows positioned to keep up with the height. The kitchen backsplash is handmade artisan tile with an Atomic Age-inspired design. But the feature that delights him the most is simple, a brass doorknob. It used to be on his bedroom door in his childhood home, back in that old century ranch. It and he look quite at home in this one. Well, as I like to do occasionally, let's do the quiz in our state magazine. Of course, I always have to pause to look up the answers because I generally don't know them myself. Occasionally, I do well, but I've got to get that answer page ready to go here so I can tell you what the answers are. So here we go. Art for all. On city walls and in picturesque parks, public art brings a splash of color to our everyday lives. Number one, North Carolina artist Jim Gallucci's sculpture, Imminent Great Two, was permanently installed in Raleigh in 2010. The powder-coated steel piece stands 12 feet high and represents the artist's family coming to America from what country in the 1930s? England, Italy, or Germany. Now, I ought to know this one because I did audio description for Imminent Great Two, among other pieces of Raleigh art, and you can find them all on the Triangle Radio Serving Services website. That's triangleradingservice.org, and it's in the podcast section. But I don't really remember. I'm thinking Italy. Let's see how I did. Oh, I'm right. It is Italy. That's where Imminent Great Two was thought of to be designed here. In addition to its more than 1,800 animals, the North Carolina Zoo has around 50 works of art representing different species and their habitats. The zoo is located in Asheboro in what county? I know this one too. Guilford, Ashe, or Randolph? And the answer is I'm wrong. It's in Randolph County. It's not in Ashe County. So, number three, one of Durham's most recognizable pieces of public art is a large bull that stands in the Central Carolina Bank Plaza. This bronze bovine goes by what name, which was the World War II military rank of CCB President George Hill? Captain, Colonel, or Major? And I know this one also because I've been there and helped the students at Duke University do audio description for it. That would be C, Major. Major the bull. Number four, Cherokee honors its Native American heritage with around 20 brightly painted life-size bear sculptures created by local artists. Some of the bears feature symbols from the Cherokee alphabet, which was created by what man? Tecumseh, Sequoia, or Quala? The answer is Sequoia. Number five out of nine, Halifax County has installed a number of vibrant sculptures resembling rockfish throughout the Roanoke Valley. One of these fanciful fish can be found on the public library building in what town? Roanoke Rapids, Oxford, or Spring Hope? It is Roanoke Rapids. The North Carolina Arboretum began collecting a variety of public art in 1989, including ceramic sculptures, fiber art, and paintings. Now visitors can see roughly 200 pieces at this popular destination, which is located in what city? That's the North Carolina Arboretum, Asheville, Raleigh, or Wilmington? And the answer is Asheville. The city of Wilson has an entire park filled with Wallace Simpson's whirligigs, and an annual festival honors the late artists. Simpson lived in what town just south of Wilson? Lucama, Sunnyside, or Hope Mills? And the answer is Lucama. From 2002 to 2004, the Winged Horse Extravaganza saw nearly 100 life-sized fiberglass horses with aircraft wings displayed in the Outer Banks. This event commemorated the centennial of the Wright brothers' first flight near what town? Kill Devil Hills, Kitty Hawk, or Nag's Head? The answer is Kitty Hawk. The Asheville Urban Trail is a nearly 2-mile walk with a variety of public art and local history. Artwork ranges from a huge flat iron to bronze pigs and turkeys on this tour that starts in what famous square? This is the Asheville Urban Square we're talking about. Biltmore, Buncombe, or Pack Square? If you said Pack Square, you are correct. And now we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. And if you have any questions or comments, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.